available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org/mobile. Produced by Kathy Roach, Joy Biles, be well, do good work, keep in touch.
It's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, where listeners like you produce your own program. This airtime is a free service offered to those interested in sharing their knowledge, talent, and passions. This is also a space to audition new programming. Opinions expressed in Open Journal may not reflect the views of the Pacifica Foundation, its staff, board, or volunteers. Information shared on Open Journal should not take the place of appropriate professional consultation. Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston.
Welcome to Open Journal. This is Mike Koenig, and you're listening to Think Wing Radio on Open Journal on KPFT 90.1 FM. Today we're going to be talking about homelessness, specifically homelessness in Hawaii. Now, homelessness is a problem all over the world. Each place has its unique aspects, but Hawaii is a group of islands in the middle of the Pacific, meaning it's surrounded by thousands of miles of ocean. Most of us think of Hawaii as a paradise we would love to visit, if even just once, and all the tourism guides tell us so, and that must sound pretty good to a homeless person, but is the paradise they expect the paradise they find? This is the second of two interviews on the problem of homelessness in Hawaii and its particular aspects. My guest today is Colin C. Kippen. He has, since June of 2012, been the State Homelessness Coordinator, or Homelessness Czar, for the Department of Human Services of Hawaii. Mr. Kippen is a native Hawaiian and has held numerous high-ranking positions in many nonprofit and governmental organizations, done some legislative work, and has spent many years dealing with various aspects of the Native American experience in the United States, both on the mainland and in the Hawaiian Islands. May I call you Colin?
Sure.
Thank you so much, Colin. So, homelessness in Hawaii. I visited there in December and was kind of startled at just the different nature of homelessness there and what also I learned is sometimes called houselessness. Can you tell us, to the extent there is a distinction, what that distinction is?
Well, aloha, Mike, and thanks for shining a light on this. So, so this idea about homelessness and houselessness, I think that term originated, the idea of being houseless, at least here in Hawaii, has originated with Native Hawaiians who view Hawaii as their homelands. But for those who find themselves on the margin economically or who are not able to afford a house, the term has evolved into being called houseless, because this is their homelands, they're indigenous to this place, but they can't afford to live here. And I'm not saying all, but I can tell you that about 28% of our homeless population are Native Hawaiians.
Now, that's an interesting statistic, because I imagine that many of the majority culture on the mainland would have suspected that the majority would be Native Hawaiians, and it doesn't work out that way necessarily.
No, because in-migration has occurred, and Hawaii has really collected people from all over the world. You know, people come here for various reasons, and I think that one of the reasons, and I know that, for example, this next year we're anticipating somewhere between 8 to 9 million tourists visiting. And some of those people who visit may decide to make their homes here. People are being called to Hawaii. It's a beautiful place to be from all over the world.
It's legendary.
And we get our millionaires and we get our working class folks, and I believe we also get folks who end up becoming homeless.
Do you think that you get some people that come there as a last ditch, or do you think it's people that come there with some prospects and then things just fall through on them?
Well, you know, the difficulty with Hawaii is that we're a very small set of isolated islands. So, for example, if you were to travel to Portland, Oregon, for example, and look for a job and things didn't work out, you could just drive north into Vancouver, which is in Washington State, and look for a job. Or you can continue up the I-5 corridor into Olympia or Tacoma or Seattle or Everett. This is all within a couple of hours of driving. Here, you're not so mobile. I mean, if you land on an island here and the job opportunities don't pan out, where do you go? It's an expensive plane ride to another major metropolis. Our isolation creates issues for people who come here and then, for whatever reason, don't have things work out.
So homelessness has, to what extent is that a historic problem in Hawaii, and to what extent has that become more of a modern problem?
I could tell you that as a child growing up, there were homeless people here in Hawaii, and I can tell you that historically, if you look at, and I happen to know quite a bit about Native Hawaiian history, but if you look at Native Hawaiian history, when the economy evolved from a subsistence economy to a market economy with the growth of our plantations, what happened is you had whole communities who basically were no longer viable and able to survive. And so you had this mass movement of people from rural areas into the cities. And so when that occurred, you had high rates of homelessness, primarily amongst Native Hawaiians. But in part of it was because the way that people lived was changing. One of the big things that happened in our history was a diversion of water from the windward sides of islands to the more leeward sides of the islands. And when that occurred, you had communities that were dependent upon water to survive, being forced, no longer able to live their sustainable lifestyle on the windward side, so they had to go to the leeward sides where there were larger communities. And it started with a sugar cane, but then it ended up becoming pineapple in later years. But again, we went from being a sustainable economy where we basically grew and consumed everything that we needed to support 800,000 people approximately, to now a state where we import approximately 90% of what we consume here. So things have substantially changed over the years, and I'm not here, I'm a modern day man. I understand the realities, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to regrow some of the things and reestablish some of the things that we used to do, like sustainable agriculture here in Hawaii. But really, it raises all sorts of issues for us that we don't have it now in the way of food security and our security, just to be able to survive in the event there were a catastrophic event, in the event that the ports were to shut down, in the event that the shipping lanes were closed in some way, or there was some sort of armed intervention or something from some foreign power. You can just imagine what would happen if the docks weren't open and you weren't able to bring these big container vessels in that bring 90% of what we consume.
Now, let me ask you a question. You'd been talking about the agricultural uses of land, sugarcane, pineapple, dislocation of people with movement of water, etc. And I think this comes back to the fact that more than most places, real estate in Hawaii is really finite. I mean, you can feel the finiteness of the real estate in Hawaii. So the question, you and I personally have talked about so-called gentlemen's estates where you have 1.5 acres of property worth $5 million. They're only paying $5,800 a year in property taxes because they claim it presumably as an agricultural land. And I mean, I don't want to go into all the details on that, but it's really, really interesting. And it sort of rubs up against two problems. One is preserving the land in Hawaii, because you don't necessarily want to turn all of Hawaii into what amounts to Singapore or Hong Kong. So on the one hand, you're trying to preserve the land, but on the other hand, you need affordable housing. That's going to entail construction. You need tax revenue in order to do these sorts of things. Where's the balance here for you? Where's the balance in Hawaii for this?
Well, the question you raise really is the question of we live on an island. we live on a set of islands, and land is finite. And the other conversation is a conversation that we were having earlier about Hawaii being known to the world, you know, as a beautiful place. And so what you end up with is you end up with dollars, people vacationing here and deciding, you know, to move here.
Mm-hmm.
And when demand substantially exceeds supply, basic economics tell us that the price goes up. So when you think about the fact that demand here is constantly going up because there's a constant inflow of folks with dollars who are able to bid into this market, you know, for whatever reasons, to buy condominiums or to buy homes which they may occupy, you know, for just a part of the year. When you think about the fact that all of that is, so all of this great demand is now flowing into Hawaii, and the supply of what we have is limited, what you're going to see is the prices go up. And that, in fact, is our experience. I mean, on this island, the average cost for a relatively small home here is about $650,000.
Now, what would that constitute? And by the way, I need to do it.
Something about 2,000 square feet or less.
Wow.
I mean, I could tell you, I have, you know, I married into a very large family. My wife for many years is from a very large family in Minnesota. I have nieces and nephews who have just regular jobs. You know, none of them have gone to college that I'm aware of. Oh, well, actually a couple have, but most haven't. And they have regular jobs, and they're able to buy homes in their state in the $80,000 to $120,000 range.
Sure.
Now here, you won't even be able to get into the game for less than a $500,000.
The land basically would just be $80,000 or $90,000.
It would take to support that ability. I think you start to understand the issue of supply and demand here. The fact that we simply don't have enough land, and again, you know. So the question of building here is that, you know, it is a beautiful place. There are things that are so unique about it, but urban sprawl is something that we're all aware of even here. And so we're always trying to think of ways that we can build housing that's affordable for people, that's close to transportation centers, that's close to where the jobs are located.
You were talking about development, Colin, and the trade-offs that have to take place between urbanizing areas and maintaining the islands to be the islands that they are, the places that people love. So
you know, there has to. I see where you're going with the question. I mean, really, there. If you think about what you need to provide for folks to be able to live, obviously, what you want is you want them to be able to afford to live here.
Right.
And the reality of Hawaii is there's some really interesting statistics that I have come across. And you know, one of the big issues I think is just the not only the high cost of housing here, but also the fact that in some ways we're on the margin here. I'm looking at a report. It's called The State of Poverty in Hawaii. It was published in April of 2012 by the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Economic Law and Economic Justice. And what this report basically says is that Hawaii is one of the most expensive places to live, yet the average wage here is the lowest in the 50 states.
Wow.
It goes through some of the statistics about what it would require for a two-bedroom apartment. So in order to be able to pay the fair market rent for a two-bedroom, so in Hawaii we have nearly 50% of our folks, 50% of our households pay more than 30% of their income for housing each month. The HUD, Housing and Urban Development, agency says that the guideline is that we should spend no more than 30% of our income on rent, but approximately 50% of our households here pay more than 30% of their income on housing per month. And actually, this is the highest percentage in the country.
Let me just take a quick station break. This is KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. We're going to take a short break for weather and traffic, and then we'll be right back.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. The time is 9:45. Here's a quick look at traffic and weather. There are no accidents reported currently. There is slow traffic on 59, East Tex Freeway inbound from Quitman to 45. Travel time is just under 12 minutes there. And on I-10, the East Freeway inbound from the 610 East Loop to Lockwood, travel time is about 7 minutes. And on 45, the North Freeway inbound from Aldine Bender to North Shepherd, the travel time is currently just over 11 minutes. The current temperature is 45 degrees, and you can expect scattered showers and thunderstorms today, mainly before 1 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be cloudy. The chance of precipitation is 50%. Today's high will be around 67 degrees, and tonight's low around 49 degrees. Air quality is in the good range. Please stay tuned after the community spotlight for Bird Note, followed by Wide Open Spaces at 10 o'clock, and then Generation Radio at 1 o'clock. And now back to the community spotlight, Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and he's talking about Hawaii. Why homelessness?
Okay, and now we'll resume. I'm Mike Honig. We do a show here called Think Wing Radio, and my guest today is Colin Kippen. He is the director in charge of, actually, I set aside your title there, the homelessness coordinator for the Department of Human Services of Hawaii, and we're talking about the unique aspects of homelessness in Hawaii, and I'm sorry, I interrupted you earlier when you were giving, when you were reporting the rent for a two-bedroom. Could you go over that again, please, because I spoke over you.
Yeah, so the fair market rent that's required here is approximately $1,700 a month.
That's a two-bedroom with what, like a kitchenette?
Yep, two-bedroom with just a normal two-bedroom garden variety kind of apartment. So you're starting to get a sense as what it's like being on the margin here if you're an individual who doesn't have a high-paying job. Interesting thing here is that in our area, and what they do is they take an average, in our area, the area median income is about $64,000 for a family of four.
Which on the mainland is sort of middle income.
Statistic for you here. Here. So if you have a family of four here, your area median income is set at $82,000. Now, when you think about $82,000 for a family of four, that's a very high number.
Yes.
And a disproportionate number of the families that I work with are in the 10 to 30% range of what they earn annually. So they're virtually just priced out of the market.
Well, from earlier interviews I've done, I think that when you're looking at about $85,000 a year for a family, I think that that puts you, like, on the mainland at least, in roughly the top 30% of earners.
Yeah, not here.
Not
here.
There.
And that's an interesting... an interesting factor here. There's another interesting fact is that the number of Hawaii residents per 1,000 who are doubled up living with family or friends because of their economic situation is 17. 17 residents per 1,000 are doubled up in their in other words, they don't appear as homeless because they do have a home, but
they have a
shelter with someone else. And
yeah.
I can tell you, I think that's a reality here. I mean, the neighborhood that I grew up in, for example, they were built in the early 50s, and they were small three-bedroom homes. If you drive down the streets that I grew up on, what you'll see in many of the homes is there's no off-street parking because it's all taken. There's no front yard because the front yard has been converted to a parking lot. Mm. The garage is now another room. They've added off to the back, and the patio is now another room. And you'll have anywhere from 3 to 4 generations living together. So you'll have grandparents, parents, and grandkids all living together because of the high cost of living. I can also just give you an anecdote here. You know, I have 3 children. All have gone to college. All have graduated. All are working. 2 of them don't live here, and the 3rd one lives with me. And as my oldest has said to me, "Dad, I'll own a home when you die."
That's a bright thought.
Here is very, very high, and not the least of which is because people from all over the world are cutting into our community with their dollars, their disposable dollars, to be able to buy housing. What I'm trying to illustrate is that this is a real issue out here, primarily just because of the high cost of development and the shortage of land. So when we're thinking about affordable housing, what we really have to be thinking about is what we're going to be doing in our urban core. That's where the jobs are. That's where development already occurs. And then the question arises, do we have any bright ideas about how we want to develop in the urban core? You know, and some of the bright ideas are some of the innovations that we're now seeing in places like San Francisco and New York City, where they're building very small units, where they're using those units now to provide housing for people in a less expensive way. And I think some of those innovations are things that the people that I work with are seriously thinking about in terms of the kinds of strategies and plans that we could put together to do this.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and I would love to follow up on your topic, but this is something that I'm curious about, and we're running out of time. Do you have a statistic on the number of people that work more or less full-time jobs that still are essentially homeless or houseless? And I ask this because I think that there is a feeling among many that if you're working a full-time job, you should be able to afford to house yourself.
I've got 2 sets of statistics. Now, these are working-age homeless people who are employed when they enter into a shelter. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that number, the percentage of, and so we categorize homeless individuals in 2 ways. Those who are in emergency or transitional shelters, and those who are living on the streets. Okay?
All right.
So of those who are in sheltered, approximately 28% are employed.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
Who are living in the shelter. Of those who are living on the streets, approximately 12% are employed. So that tells you, and it makes some sense. I mean, if you think about it, it makes some sense. Getting someone out of homelessness, living on the streets, to being in a transitional shelter where they can start to, you know, get a job, start to work on their credit, start to work on other issues they may have in terms of health or sobriety or those kinds of things, right? Starts to stabilize a person. So the person is starting to stabilize when they're in a shelter. And so that's why that number is more than twice of what the number is when you're just living on the street. So 28% if you're in a shelter, 12% if you're living on the street.
That's really
so
sad.
It does surprise a lot of people that number is so high of people who are homeless.
And working.
The assumption is that they're not. But when you consider part of what the issue in Hawaii is, which is the extremely high rate of housing, whether it be housing to purchase or housing to rent, and the fact that we are primarily a service-based economy, which historically and across the nation is not a high-paying industry.
Let me ask you a quick question.
What you're looking at is a very tight margin for people to make it.
Just as a point of reference for listeners, what are the prices of some staples that you might buy? A gallon of gas, a gallon of milk, a pound of meat?
Way over $4 for a gallon of gas, and have been for quite some time. A gallon of milk, you know, if it's on sale, I can get it for $7. But otherwise, if I just go pick one off, you know, I'm either in the $8 to $9 range for a gallon of milk.
Wow. And that's
And everything is more expensive because everything is being shipped in.
But when you say everything is more expensive, I think it helps to have a concrete point of reference for people who know that here they can go into their store and maybe pay $3.50, maybe $4 for a gallon of milk unless it's on sale.
Yeah, and these are just your staples, you know,
right,
in order to live.
Exactly.
But everything is more expensive here. And again, it's the high price of having to get it here. You know, one of the things that's going to be a huge factor for the future of a state like ours, which ships in, you know, the majority of what it consumes, if we can establish our own food base here to grow our own crops and to consume them here. But it's going to be the cost of oil and fossil fuels.
I think probably we need to wrap this up. Is there something you would like to say in terms of summarizing?
I think that some of the issues that we've discussed today are just unique because we live on an isolated island, or set of islands in the middle of the Pacific. That's a confounding fact. The fact that we don't have a lot of land. The fact that everything is just more expensive here. But I do think that what you'll find in places across the country, San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle, Las Vegas, New York City, all of these places, which have a lot in common with us in terms of their high cost of living, they also have very high rates of homelessness too.
Right.
And so what we're trying to do is just organize ourselves and work with these places. We don't want to invent any wheels here. We just want to reconfigure the wheels that other people have created.
Of course.
And you know, use those wheels to roll on down the road here and to do the best we can to end homelessness. And what I'm doing, and you didn't say this, but I just want to say this in closing. What I'm doing out here is I'm trying to basically assemble everyone here, communities, businesses, the government, the private sector, and when I say government, the federal government, the state governments, our county governments, which control a lot of the land use and zoning issues on their own islands, all of us working together to try to come up with creative solutions to the problem.
Well, I really appreciate your time. I know you've been incredibly busy the last few weeks, and to find a half an hour or so to talk to me is really greatly appreciated. My guest has been Colin C. Kippen. He is the Homelessness Coordinator for the Department of Human Services of Hawaii, and I wish we had more time, and maybe we'll have a chance to revisit different aspects of this topic in the future. Thank you so much for taking time today.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. We rely on listener donations. Visit kpft.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website with details. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. Listener feedback helps KPFT determine what Open Journals are appreciated by the community at large. To get in touch with the program director, send an email to pd@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 308. Please stay tuned for Wide Open Spaces coming up at 10, and thank you for tuning in to today's Open Journal here on 90.1 KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
Is Bird Note. When a Carolina wren tips back its head and sings, something remarkable happens. A Carolina wren can sing so loudly that you almost have to shout to be heard over its song. Wrens aren't the only small birds with big voices, but they are the best known for this ability. How can a bird like a Carolina wren, all of 5.5 inches long and weighing only as much as 4 nickels, produce so much sound? The answer lies in the songbird's vocal anatomy. Unlike you and I, who create sound from the larynx way up at the top of our windpipe, a bird's song comes from deep within its body. Birds produce song in a structure called the syrinx, located at the bottom of the windpipe, where the bronchial tubes diverge to the lungs. The syrinx is surrounded by an air sac, and the combination works like a resonating chamber to maintain or amplify sound. Evolution has given birds a far more elaborate sound mechanism than it's given humans. Where we wound up with a flute, songbirds got